Good evening, everyone. My name is Angel, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Angel.
Tonight, we're going to be talking about the fourth and fifth step. But before we jump in, I think it's important to share a little bit about how it was for me and how it currently is now. So, I grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, which is a hop, skip, and a jump away from here. But if you're familiar with Elizabeth, then you know it's a little... So it can be a little dangerous to live in. I lived in the hood for a while. My parents were both hardworking people, just trying to make ends meet. And my dad was a truck driver, and he was also a worker for CNC Cola Factory. My mom worked a lot of odd-end jobs. She worked at Burger King, McDonald's, she Dunkin' Donuts, she babysat. She did what she could to bring money to the table. My mom had me when she was 17, so she was a young mom. I wasn't her first child, but her first child unfortunately miscarried. And so she was just trying to figure things out. My dad was in his 30s at that point already, and it wasn't his first kid. He had another child from a previous marriage. But that marriage didn't work out. My parents were like oil and water. There were two people that just shouldn't have been together, but they were. There was a lot of domestic abuse happening at home. My mom was very physically abusive. She was very physically responsive to a lot of the triggers that my dad would, you know, set off. And my dad was very emotionally abusive at home. So sometimes they would turn that towards us. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. I'm the oldest of three. But I got the brunt of it because I had a big mouth and I didn't know how to keep my mouth shut, and I would say things. And so I grew up a lot. I grew up in a home full of abuse. I was also molested when I was 8 years old. My half brother came to live with us when I was 8. He was 18, I was 8. And this all happened during our communion, during my communion. I grew up Catholic. I went to St. Mary's Church in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Went to Spanish Mass. I did not understand a word they were saying. And I hated it. I hated going to church. But I knew it was important to my parents, so I sucked it up. When the molestation started, I remember feeling... dirty, evil, and just a lot of negative feelings about myself. And was told by my half-brother that if I told anyone, he would hurt me. So I didn't feel like I had a safe space at home. My half-brother was living with us for a year, and this abuse continued for a year. But I was going through communion, and this is my first drink and my first drunk. I was the first one to line up to drink the wine, and I saw this cup, and I guess I was thirsty that day and decided to just drink the entire glass. And I handed the chalice back to the priest, and he tried to take it away from me. He was not happy. I hiccuped back to the pews, and then my mom pinched me and was like, "Wait till you get home." When I got home, I proceeded to puke all over her couches. It was the 90s, though, so the couches were covered in plastic, so everything was safe. But she was still pretty upset. Made me shower with my clothes on and, whip me with her belt. And it was a very traumatizing experience, my first drink and my first drunk. And I was scared of consequences from my mom and from my dad, so I didn't drink again for a long time. My parents got divorced when I was 14. Thank God. I was so happy when they got divorced. Most people would be really upset and sad, but I was like, woohoo. Mostly because that meant I didn't have to spend time with my abuser anymore. My half-brother was always at the house at that point, and it was really difficult being around him. But also because I didn't have to deal with the tumultuous environment that my dad and my mom had developed over the years. My mom quickly moved on and started dating my stepdad. I don't know the whole story there. I was just a kid, so. But apparently she was seeing him while she was still in the marriage. Who knows if that's true or not? Probably is. My dad, he let his health go to the wayside. He had diabetes and he did not take care of himself. My mom was his primary caretaker. She's the one that gave him his insulin shots. He did not do it himself. And when he got divorced from my mom, he was heartbroken. As tumultuous as the relationship was, he had a really hard time letting go. He was like head over heels in love with her. And he let his health fall to the wayside and he stopped taking care of himself. And we didn't visit him very often. And he died when I was 22. He watched me graduate from college. I graduated by the skin of my teeth. I was never honest with my dad growing up. Never. I was his character. I started drinking again when I was 20. And I'm not a progressive drinker. That's not me. They talk about different drinkers in the book. I was the one who hit the ground running. As soon as I started, I couldn't stop. And my mom pointed out several times when I was 20, 21, 22, you're an alcoholic. You got some issues. And I was just turning around on her, you know. It was really easy for me to play the victim card. If you lived my life, you would be doing the things that I'm doing too. And it was really easy for me to turn it around and not take any accountability for any of my actions and point the finger right back at you. Yeah, Mom, well, you used to beat us when we were kids. Do you remember that? Do you remember taking a window fan and throwing it at me and chucking it at me? And getting really personal and saying these things in front of friends to embarrass her. Because what would she have to say? You know? It was like that for a while, but in front of my dad, I was a totally different person. I was my namesake. I was an angel. I didn't do anything wrong in front of my dad's eyes. I was a great student. Total BS. I was a good friend. Not at all. I had a girlfriend. I am gay. So, like, all of these things were just fallacies that I let my dad believe because I didn't want him to know the real me. A part of that was because when I was 8 years old, he told me that if any of us were gay, he would disown us. So I felt like I could never really be myself in front of him. I was fearful. Fear controlled my life. I allowed it to make every decision I made and every action that followed that decision. So fast forward a little bit. I drank uncontrollably and used other substances too, but we'll stick to alcohol. For 15 years. I rarely faced consequences because it was, like I said, very easy for me to turn it around and point the finger right back at you. I hit a house once when I was drunk and convinced the woman it was her fault. Don't know how I did that, but I did. And she decided not to press charges on me. I had to pay for the damages, of course, but beyond that, cops weren't called, they weren't involved, and somehow she believed me. I was one of those people that could cry on cue. As soon as something happens, I'm like, oh, here come the waterworks, you know? And it was really easy for me to just not take accountability for any of my actions. And because I never faced any dire consequences, I never saw any of my behaviors as problematic. I had a place to live. I had a car. I had a job. I had a paying salary. I mean, I barely showed up to my job. I didn't show up on time to my job ever. I'm a teacher. And I was most of the time either hungover or drunk or high at work. And nobody took notice. So I thought, I'm good. I'm safe. I have no problematic behaviors here. But it got to a point where I spent most of my life running. avoiding consequences, avoiding myself, avoiding facing who I was and how I was showing up in the world. And it got to a point where I couldn't run anymore. When I was 35, the pandemic hit. I was back home living again, in my 30s, living at home again with my mom. Because I got evicted from my apartment for failure to pay. And that was fantastic. But I went into a deep depression because of it. And I was like, well, I'm a failure, and this, that, and the other, and I'm back at home in my 30s, like, what kind of life am I living? And my depression sent me deeper into my addictions. And then I started drinking a lot with one fellow. And this fellow was a heterosexual man. He was somebody I grew up with. It was obvious he had no interest in me, but I was so deluded that I believed he did. And I allowed myself to have feelings for this person. And at a certain point, I couldn't hold it in anymore, and I had to just tell him how I felt. So one night, we're playing beer pong, and it's true for dare beer pong. And he says, dare, and he's like, tell me something you've never told me before. And I'm like, okay, I love you. And he's like, what? And I'm like, I love you. He's like, I love you too, man. And I'm like, no, I love you. And he's like, oh, dude, I'm not gay. Like, you know, you're a good-looking guy, but I'm not into guys. And I was devastated. And in disbelief. I was like, what? No, you're into me. I could not believe it. I was just like, no, you're totally into me. And he was like, no, I'm definitely not. And it destroyed our friendship. He didn't know how to respond or react. He never had dealt with that before. So he stopped talking to me. And I didn't know what to do with that, and I started spinning. It got to a point where using and drinking wasn't enough, and I couldn't fill this hole that I had inside of my heart, and I just needed to do something about it. So one night I was with a friend, and I mentioned something off the cuff of you know, not wanting to live anymore. And he paid attention to that. He was somebody I grew up with. We went to middle school together. And it wasn't the first time he saw me do some problematic self-destruction behavior. And he recognized that this was something that could potentially be bigger than all the other times. And he followed me home. And he caught me mid-noose, trying to take my own life. And he tackled me to the ground and pinned me down and sobbingly was pleading for me to please stop. And I fought him, but he was a lot stronger than I was. And I hadn't eaten in a couple of days, so I had no energy. And he just told me, please, I'm going to stay with you until the morning. Tell your mom you need help. So he did. He stayed with me until 6 a.m. We sat outside, smoked cigarettes. And then my mom comes out. She's like, what's going on? I tell her I don't want to live anymore. She tells me to get in the car. We call one of my friends. She's a social worker. I'm like, what do I do? She's like, go here. I went to Overlook. And I stayed in the mental health facility for 2 weeks. I spent my birthday there. I got free socks. I met new people. It was a really interesting experience. But one thing they told me immediately, almost right off the cuff, like second or third day there. Yeah, so you're bipolar, but you're also an alcoholic. I was like, cool, what do we do about the bipolar thing? I was not ready to look at the alcoholism. I was not ready to be told by another person that I was an alcoholic. And I wasn't ready to accept it myself. But I got out of the mental health facility, and I was put in the IOP program, an intensive outpatient program. And my mom gave me an ultimatum at this point. She said, you're going to stay sober and do this program, or you're going to need somewhere else to live. At this point, I had burned all my bridges. I had nowhere else to go, so I figured, why not? Might as well do what she says. And I begrudgingly stopped using August 14th, so my sobriety day is August 15th, 2020. I went to all the meetings that the ALP provided. I did a lot of online Zoom meetings. I avoided AA like the plague. I did not want anything to do with a spiritual approach. I blamed God for a lot of the things that happened in my life. I believed in a higher power. I just didn't like him. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want anything to do with something that was spiritually based. And I also couldn't separate the spirituality from religion. And I didn't want to be punished for my behavior. And I saw religion and God as a punishing force. And I avoided it. So for 8 months, I was dry. I didn't really attend the program. I went to all these Zoom meetings, Smart Recovery, Dharma Recovery. And listen, if they work for you, you're probably not an alcoholic, but they work. But they weren't working for me. And I started spitting again. And I started having dark thoughts again. And then by the grace of God, I went to an all-recovery meeting on Zoom. And this man, all pathways of recovery were welcome in this meeting. And this young man gets up there and he starts sharing his experience. He's telling us he's got 4 years of sober time under his belt. He's 20. So this kid got sober at 16. And immediately I'm like, I'm not buying it. I don't believe this guy at all. This guy is just full of it. There's no way. And contempt prior to our investigation, right? And right away I'm like, there's just no way. But then I'm listening and I'm hearing and there's just something about him. And I can tell he's honest. I can tell he's sincere. I can tell he's connected to something that I'm not. And I see it in his eyes, like all in the eyes, right? So I got his number after the meeting. And we talked. And he said, if you want what I got, come to AA. And for a while, I said no. For a week, exactly, actually. And he called me every day until he wore me down. And I eventually showed up at the Millington Young People's Meeting, which is Basking Ridge, New Jersey. And I remember walking into this basement and feeling a lot of fear and uncertainty. And I didn't know what this was going to be like. I'd never been to an AA meeting at this point. As soon as that meeting started, I felt loved, appreciated, seen, and welcomed. And I knew I was home. I knew I was where I was supposed to be. But I still didn't do the suggestions people gave me. I just was like, well, meeting makers make it. If I just keep showing up, I'm sure I'll get this through osmosis. And that wasn't true. And eventually I got to a point where I was desperate enough to start listening to these suggestions. And I got a sponsor, and we started working the steps. Step one was easy for me. At that point, I was beaten down enough to really admit and be honest and say, yes, I am an alcoholic. I have this allergy. I have this physical allergy the book talks about. I have the mental obsession. I have the spiritual malady. Spiritual malady, I was a little on the fence about. But the other two, the first two, absolutely, I saw it. When I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. You know? And so, like, I had it. And the allergy was very obvious to me. I couldn't just stop at one. There's just, like, I was never that person to have one drink. So that was all obvious to me, and it made sense. And then how is my life unmanageable? That was also pretty evident to me. I'm 30, in my 30s, living at home again. Because I couldn't pay my rent because I was using it on booze. I don't have any relationships with anyone. I'm depressed. I'm a prey of misery. You know, all those bedevilments that are in the book. Yes, 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 yes. To every single one of them. Step one is the only step that I say that we do perfectly. And I think I did it pretty perfectly. So it was a big yes for me. Then we get to step two. And at this point in my sobriety, I was treating the steps like a checklist. I was like, let me just get it done and then be on my way. And maybe I'll get this thing that everybody else has. And so step two, you know, came to believe. I had believed in a higher power. I just blamed my higher power for everything that happened to me. So came to believe, yeah, the belief's there. The relationship isn't. So the belief was there. My sponsor was like, do you believe that I believe? I was like, yeah. He's like, all right, let's do step three. And then we got on our knees and we started praying. And I hadn't done that since I was in Catholic school. And it actually brought a lot of antithesis for me. I didn't like it. And it made me uncomfortable. But after doing it, I felt better. But I still didn't want to give everything to God. I didn't know how to. And my sponsor said something to me. He's like, we do it by doing the rest of these steps. And I said, okay, whatever. It didn't make sense to me at the time. But I just listened to whatever he told me to do. Because I was desperate enough. So we started doing our fourth step. And the fourth step is a personal inventory that we take, right? And I had a lot of resentments in my life. So it was really easy to do those first three columns. You know, who am I resentful at? Why am I resentful at them? What does it affect? Does it affect my self-esteem, my security, my ambitions, my personal or sex relations? What was being interfered with? That was lots of fun for me. I had a lot of fun writing those things down, honestly, because anger was like a drug for me. It was intoxicating. I loved being angry, especially if I thought it was justified. So it felt really good to get these things on paper. I wrote all these things down. And something my sponsor told me, he kept emphasizing, was that resentments are going to kill us. If we don't process them, if we don't do this step, if we don't do these inventories, we will go out and drink again. We will die. My sponsor now gave me a little deeper understanding. So my mom found my inventory. I left it on the couch one night. I was writing and I just fell asleep and I just got tired. And I left it on the couch. And I woke up late. And when I woke up, it was in a different spot. So I knew she went through it. And I called my sponsor and I'm livid. I'm angry that she went through it. Mostly because on the front it says, do not open. So I'm like, what is she doing? You know, this is my personal property. How dare she? And I was very angry and up in arms, and I called my sponsor. My sponsor was like, okay, calm down. We don't know anything. And I'm like, no, I know she went through it. So even if she did, just listen to her. And I was so angry with him because I was expecting some sage wisdom, and the only thing he had for me was just listen to her. But that was something I had never done. I had never just listened to my mom. I saw her as this villain, as an arch nemesis in my life. I saw her as this person who physically abused me. I saw her as this person who failed at raising me. I saw her as this, you know, hateful, spiteful woman. And I couldn't see beyond that. So I never just listened to her. So I get home, my mom's cleaning, and salsa music is playing, so I know she's angry. When a Puerto Rican woman is cleaning and there's salsa music playing, she's not happy. And I try to tiptoe, and I'm like, maybe I don't have to have this, you know, altercation with her. And she hears me, and she walks over, and the first thing she says to me is, am I a bad mother? And I said, no, you're not. And I was like, why are you asking me that? And she said, yeah, she asked me again. And then I said, no, you're not. She's like, answer me. I was like, I did. I said no. And And she's like, well, in your book it says I am. And she's like, why do you hate me? She said, she was understanding that resentment meant hatred. And I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to articulate my words well then. And I didn't know how to explain to her what a resentment really was. My sponsor also didn't give me the vocabulary at the time, but I have a new sponsor now. Resentment isn't hatred. Resentment are things that we feel again. Because we haven't processed them, because we haven't let them go. Because there are things that are still on the very tip of our brain. And we feel them again when we think about them. We feel the anger. We feel the hurt. But it's not hatred. I didn't have the words then, but I do now, and I had a talk with my mom about it. Thankfully, though, that experience of her reading my fourth step and seeing her name was the first one, you know, mom. You moms are usually the first ones on our resentments list. And then dad was, like, closely under. But my sponsor's words kept ringing in my ear. Just listen to her, just listen to her, just listen to her. Because I wanted to react. I wanted to respond. I wanted to be angry. But I just listened. And for the first time ever, I saw my mom in a different light. I saw this woman who was reaching out in pain. This woman who wanted to help, who wanted to be there for me, but didn't know how to. And now that's all I see when I look at my mom. This woman who tried her best with the tools that she was given to her, you know? And it brought us a lot closer, that experience. And I skipped a few steps, but I made an amends to her right then and there, you know? I mean, I made an amends to her again when I got to my amends step. But right then and there was that opportunity to have a real open, transparent conversation with her. And we've been close ever since. She's my best friend. And I never thought I would have that relationship with my mother, ever. So, after that experience, I didn't really want to continue the step work. I was scared. I was like, what if my mom reads some more stuff? You know, and especially the sex inventory and things like that. So my sponsor was like, why don't you keep it in your car and lock your car at night? And I said, okay, that's a good suggestion. So we did that. And then we get to the fourth column of our resentments inventory, and I have to look at my faults. And I am stuck. I don't know how to do that. I've never taken accountability for anything ever in my life, and now I have to sit there and look at these things and see how and where I was wrong. And in a lot of them, I didn't feel like I was wrong in any of them. So I'm sitting outside the meeting one day, I'm on the bench, and this man comes up to me. His name is Roger. Roger had 4 years of recovery at that point. He was a spiritual giant at our meeting. He talked about God like God was his best friend. And I didn't like him. I did not like him at all. And he comes up to me and he goes, what's going on, buddy? And I was like, oh, here we go. I'm like, I don't know, I'm just doing my fourth step. And he's like, yeah, what's got you stuck? And I said, I can't really see my faults in any of these things. He's like, have you tried praying? And I got so angry. I was like, get out of here, man. Like, that's your solution for everything. And I didn't get it. I didn't have the wisdom that he did. He's like, take a break, pray on it, and come back to it. I was like, you know what, whatever. I'm going to give it a try. Let's see. I mean, this guy's got some time under his belt. Maybe he's right. So I did that. I prayed on it. I did the third step prayer all over again. And then it kind of, all these things started coming to my head, and God speaks to me in a really funny way. I don't know how it is for y'all, but it's like these thoughts that start in the back of my head and then travel to the front. That's how it feels, like a small voice that gets louder. And that's what it was. And all these things started cropping up. And I started writing. I got my fourth step done that night from some simple advice. But there was one resentment I couldn't figure out. And it was the resentment against my half-brother. How do I find my fault in someone who took advantage of me when I was 8 years old? Who molested me when I was 8? How do I find my fault in that? I was 8 years old. What did I do wrong there? And I passively wrote, should have told someone sooner. But I knew that wasn't the answer. But I wrote it anyway. And then I continued. Now, the first time I did my inventory, my sponsor didn't have me do a fear inventory the way it's supposed to be done. I just listed my fears. Now, that's not how it's done here. The book gives us specific instructions on how to do our fear inventory. It says, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So that's the first column, right? We write down our fears. We asked ourselves why we had these fears. That's the second column. Why do we have these fears? Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Yes. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. So, the first column is what the fear is. The second column, why do we have the fear? You know, the third column, what does it affect? What parts of self is it affecting? And then the last column, how would God have us be instead? How would God have us show up? And so I'm redoing my steps, and I recently did my fear inventory again. But the first time I just listed them. And then we get to the sex inventory. And again, they give you very specific instructions on how to do this. We reviewed our own conduct over the years. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? It doesn't say if. It says where. So that means that we have been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate, probably with every single person who's on this list. Whom had we hurt? That's the first column, right? The second column is what had we done? What did we do? And then the third column is where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Where? Again, not if. Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? My sponsor likes to say, it's how have we unjustifiably aroused jealousy, bitterness, or suspicion? Now, it may not apply to all cases. Jealousy might not be involved in everything. But my sponsor likes to think, well, think of the person. What if this person knew you were doing this behavior? How would they feel? You know? Where were we at fault? The big one. Right? And then what should we have done instead? What would God have us do instead? After writing these inventories, my friend Roger passed away. He died in a motorcycle accident. And it was really hard for me to continue doing the work. I was grieving. And on top of his passing, his sponsee, who he was working with, died a week later. He went out and he got into 12 hit and runs in one day until he ended up under a bus. So I lost two people I was really close with in a week span, and I didn't know what to do. But I know Roger would have wanted me to continue with the steps. He was the one that helped me get my fourth step done. So I did it in his honor. And I remember we went to Liberty State Park, and me and my sponsor, and we were surrounded by monarch butterflies just flying all around us. And it's really important to do your fifth step with your sponsor. We're so fortunate that we have sponsors. It says in the book we can do it with a clergyman. We can do it with somebody else that we trust. But we have the opportunity to do it with somebody who gets this, who's been where we are, who's probably lived our experience, or similar to what we've experienced, and won't judge us, will only love us. And so I'm sitting there and I'm telling my sponsor these things, and then I get to that place where I'm like, I don't know what to say here, you know? I get to that resentment against my half-brother. And he's like, what's your fault in this? And I say, I should have told someone sooner. He said, Angel, you were 8 years old. He's like, I'm going to give you some time. Pray on it, and I'll come back in 30 minutes. And I was actually pretty angry because I thought that was a good answer in my head, but I guess not. So I prayed on it. And I just kept saying, God, just get me out of my own way. I am blocking myself from your light and your wisdom. Please impart with me what you know, because I don't know anything. And then it came to me. It was obvious. When I had really took a look at my inventory, it was obvious. The answer was there all along. I used this experience. I weaponized it. I used it as a shield. I played the victim whenever it was opportunistic for me to do so, whenever I could get something out of it. And beyond that, I wouldn't let this go. Those were my faults here. I wouldn't let it go. So my sponsor comes back, and I share this with him, and he starts crying. And then I start crying. And then we're both crying. And he's like, oh, yeah, let's take a break before we do your fear inventory. And I'm like, okay, great. And then we do the fears, and we do the sex, and we do the harms. And I get to a point in my sex and harms inventory where there are things that I know I'm not saying and I should be saying, but there's fear wrapped up around it. And even though I had this amazing experience with my sponsor, there were certain things I just couldn't say at that point in my recovery. There was just, I couldn't get it off my chest. And so I didn't. And I kept it in. And it says in our book to be thorough. It says, be as honest as you can be. Our secrets keep us safe. Our secrets keep us sick. And I knew that. I knew that from doing the readings. And I knew that. And I didn't want to be sick. But there were certain things I didn't feel comfortable sharing at that point. And he tells me to meditate for an hour. And he leaves. And I'm sitting on the park bench and I'm meditating and I'm crying at the same time. I'm sobbing. I had this experience of like, I felt God was there. I felt Him. I felt God was there, but I also was still angry with God. And I kept saying in my head, where were you? Where were you when I was 8? Where were you when I was a kid growing up? Where were you when I was in high school trying to figure out who I was? What my sexuality was. Well, where were you when my dad died? And I kept saying that and kept in my head. It was this recurring thought that I just kept cycling. And then, as I'm having these thoughts, my eyes closed, sitting Indian style on this park bench, sobbing my booty off. This woman comes up to me. She taps me on the shoulder. Doesn't say anything and just hands me a napkin and walks away. And it was very like, okay, God, I see what you're doing. God was always there. Mm-hmm. I was the one that turned away. I was the one that turned away for whatever reason. Anger, fear, delusion. I was the one that turned away. I made that choice and that action to do so. And I felt warm. like I was being embraced. And I felt the presence of God right then and there. But like I said, I wasn't honest in my fourth step. So some years passed by. I started working with a different sponsor. My first sponsor, some things happened that I just couldn't continue working with him. So I chose to work with someone else. And this guy's a big book thumper. So he knows his way around this book. And he started taking me through the work. And he was so upset with me when I told him I didn't really do a fear inventory. And so we started doing the work, and we meet every week, and we're doing the work, and we're doing the fifth step. And I actually had finished this experience last week. And I said things to him that I've never said to another human being in my life. And I felt free. I felt free from the restrictions I put on myself. And I felt free from all those things that were weighing me down over the years and my entire life. It also didn't feel great. It was like a freedom, but also like, ooh, I really just said all that. But it brought us so much closer, and it brought me closer to my higher power, and it brought me closer to God. So I guess I say all this just to say that if we're lucky, if we're fortunate enough, we get to do these things all over again. We get to do these steps again and again and again, and we get to have different experiences. And whatever crops up, I think it's really important to just be as honest as we can be with the information present to us. Holding back, it's like you're limiting your experience with your higher power. You're limiting your experience in this program. It doesn't serve you. So get it all out. Lay it all out on the table. We're all alcoholics here. No one's going to judge you. I don't know how I have the time.
You can go to 7:30.
Okay, cool. So, there's something in the big book that I wanted to read, actually.
What page is that?
68. So, on page 68, it says, "We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear." This is something that came true for me. You know, it's something that I remember being that person that used to judge people for relying on God. My aunt is a very religious person. I used to see her as a weak person because she relied on God so heavily. And now, having had an experience myself and being a person now who relies on God, I see it as a way of strength. And I see the strength that others have when they rely on God. It takes a certain level of wisdom and understanding and trust and faith. And all of that is courageous. It's the opposite of fear. So whenever I get stuck in my fears, I try to remind myself that the opposite of fear is faith, and what I need to do is trust in my God. Trust in my higher power. This past year, I was compartmentalizing God. I was saying, God, you can have this, but this I got. And God slapped me in the face a couple of times this year and was like, you don't have this. Control isn't real. It's something we like to tell ourselves that we have so we can feel powerful. But our power comes from God. And when I turn away and when I try to take the will back into my hands and control something, I'm taking that power and I'm throwing it away too. So, I love that it says we never apologize for God. You know, we let God be, we're God's conduits. All of us. And it's all about taking that action and doing the next right thing. I wanted to also read the fifth step promises. Here it is. Once we have taken a step of holding nothing, this is on page 75, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. After my first experience, I felt some of this. After my second experience, and really being honest and thorough, and illuminating every twist of character and every dark corner of my past, all of these promises came true for me. I was able to look the world in the eye. I can be alone at perfect peace and ease. I don't like to be alone still, but I can be alone. I can be alone. My fears have started to fall from me. Now, fears are primal. Some of our fears we have keep us alive. It's the fears that we let control and direct our lives that don't. And those fears are starting to fall from me. Because I'm having this faith, I have this trust, I have this feeling that this reliance on this higher power, and I know that God's got me regardless of what I do or where I'm at in my life. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. That came true for me my first go around. After my fifth step experience, I no longer had that urge to drink. It had been taken away from me. I didn't have the feeling of wanting to use. Now, our isms show up in different ways, and that's been true in my experience for sure. Alcohol is but a symptom. And if we're not doing the work, our behaviors start to show in very different ways. But after the second experience, I'm starting to feel closer to my higher power. And you feel you're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe, you know? So it says, as long as we pocket our pride and go at it, as long as we illuminate every twist of character, as long as we share every dark cranny of our past, and we withhold nothing, we will be delighted. So long as. So yeah, these promises come true. So long as you do what's asked. That's all it takes. The directions are really clear. And they always have been. I know people use worksheets to do the inventory now. I'm not a fan of them personally, but whatever gets you to do it, gets you to do it. You know what the purpose of the fourth step is? To get it done. so you can move on and continue. Ultimately, our purpose here is to be of maximum service to other alcoholics. We can't do that if we're not being honest. I think that's all I got. Thanks, everyone.